Thank you for the introduction, and good afternoon, everybody. So the first thing I want to do is say that I'm talking about work that's been done by a number of people who actually weren't me. Vito Alacqua, Chris Nolte, Neil Fan, and Andrew Monaghan did most of the work for the modeling studies that I'm going to be talking about, but I sort of helped coordinate some of this modeling work. So this was done under the auspices of an interim national climate assessment, which was looking at climate and health. And we released the public draft for comment back in April, and I hope some of you commented, and hopefully we addressed your comments appropriately. But one part of the climate and health assessment was that we decided we wanted some of the chapter authors to do some modeling studies, trying to push the boundaries of what we could project in a quantitative fashion about climate and health impacts. So these studies, we ended up having six studies, all of which have been accepted in the peer-reviewed literature. They are included in the assessment as research highlights, so they are not, they don't have weight in terms of the key finding of the assessment any more than any of the other studies that were assessed. But they're there sort of to show, you know, what can you do, what are sort of the boundaries of some of this work. Obviously, studies are going to have very different levels of, I'll get to how some of these studies differ in a moment. But when you're dealing with modeling climate impacts, there's a number of issues that you have to consider in order. So we have a large body of literature on climate modeling in general, so projections of temperature, precipitation, sea level rise. So these are sort of the climate drivers. There's the first step in modeling a health impact. And then you actually need to think about human exposure. So are the increases of heat happening where people are living? Do you take into account urban heat islands? If you're talking about things like changes in infectious diseases, do you need to think about changes in distribution of the vectors? If you're talking about water quality, are you looking at how flooding is pouring more pollutants into the rivers and sort of all of these and leading to actual people drinking it? So that's sort of the exposure pathways. And then the health outcomes are what we really want to model, is, you know, how many people are dying or getting sick because of these changes. But because they're at this end of this chain of modeling issues, it can be challenging to get all the way to the number of heart attacks or the number of additional cases of Lyme or whatever it is your endpoint is. And then there's sort of modifying this and being modified by the climate changes are issues about the population, vulnerable groups, infrastructure, health infrastructure both matters because, you know, if you have good hospitals, obviously, like, you can deal with heat waves or air quality incidents, and people who might have died can be helped, but they can also be impacted by climate change, and if you have weather events, they can affect the health infrastructure that you're depending on. And so whether or not you address all of these things in your modeling study is an open question depending on how advanced that particular modeling area is. So there are a number of uncertainties to think about. In climate projections, emission pathways and climate sensitivity and what model you use are sort of standard uncertainties that we look at. When you think about uncertainties in exposure, this begins to become more challenging because you're talking about, are people going to change how they behave? Are they going to go out into the woods more or less, spend more time indoors, outside? And then I think here we have a lot of people who are in the epidemiology community, and so you all know the uncertainties involved in estimating exposure-response relationships better than I do, probably. And then finally, the health outcomes. So we had six studies with seven total endpoints. I will actually be presenting again tomorrow afternoon on heat impacts. Today I'll be talking about the ozone-related effects of climate change, infiltration in indoor air, and the change in the onset week of Lyme disease. Unfortunately, we didn't have a speaker come to talk about the water-related illnesses, but we do have research highlights on changes in Vibrio in the Chesapeake Bay and off the coast of Alaska as warming allows Vibrio to basically expand north and change its seasonal pattern. Harmful algal blooms in the Sound, and fish poisoning in the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean. Oh, and as long as I'm mentioning the fact that there's going to be a session tomorrow, Allison Crimmins will also be talking about the health assessment as a whole. So more than just these research highlights. So that would be good to go to. So in terms of the three studies that I'll be talking about now, our gold standard for the studies is we had a bunch of ideas in mind for what we wanted in an ideal world. And then we recognize that there are many realities and you couldn't necessarily get there. So ideally, all of the studies we looked at would have reached mortality and morbidity as a modeled endpoint. But for something like Lyme disease, where you know trying to calculate the number of additional cases of Lyme is challenging because of all these issues I talked about human behavior, about sort of medical responses, things like that, weren't able to get there. Similarly with indoor air, sort of we were up to the point of calculating changes in air exchanges, but not morbidity and mortality. For time frame, we were looking at 2050 and 2100 was sort of our goal, but we were leveraging existing work. And so the EPA modelers for the ozone work, they often look at 2030 as a standard endpoint for regulatory impact assessment. And so that's what we drew on for this. For temporal resolution, 30 years is sort of the standard climate gold standard. Computationally, that can be very expensive, and so you can't always get there. We wanted RCP 6.0, sort of what we wanted to have across all the studies, which we got all of them except one. And you can see we do have one SRES scenario that we looked at. But some of the studies got to go beyond just RCP 6 and look at the RCPs, which gives you a sort of a better story about the benefits, potential benefits of mitigation, but that wasn't something we had as a standard request. Multiple climate models, and then here I use the term bias correction, but it's basically to talk about how well do the models address impacts where the people are. So models have, you know, 1 degree by 1 degree resolution, but climate impacts happen at a individual level. So for some of these, we've done dynamic downscaling work. For some, we had historical weather stations, and we looked at how the climate changed in the 1 degree by 1 degree grid square, and then used that change from the model to modify the observed changes in at that weather station. So it's much closer to maybe what you would expect or what you'd be using for the epidemiology. And finally, we wanted to get a national scope, which at least the air quality one was mostly national. I think it didn't do Alaska or Hawaii. But some of the other studies had to limit to a number of different, a limited subset of cities or states, depending on available data and how much they could get done. So I want to go very quickly through the three studies just to show you a taste of these results, and I'll try and talk at the end about some of the takeaway lessons that we got overall. So for air quality, you start with the CMIP scenario, and then you use that as an input to downscale to 36 kilometer resolution. We used emissions in 2030 for both the 2030 time point, but also the historical time point. So we're isolating the effects of climate change without sort of trying to consider multiple changing variables at the same time. This is a little bit of an advancement, and a lot of the work to date has looked at current emissions, and the authors really thought that, in the future, we're going to have lower emissions, so it might be more realistic to look at that. I think there's a couple of other talks here by several people on air quality issues, and they all sort of take interesting and sort of next steps. There's a lot of more work on air quality than on a lot of the other areas that we looked at. So this study was more one additional study in a set as versus being really a push forward. There was meteorology from the downscaling and the 2030 emissions were then used as inputs to an air quality model, which was used as an input to BenMap, which is the usual health model we use for our RIAs. And I've included here the authors in the study, so that's published and I think publicly accessible. So here's the temperature change that we're seeing in 2030 from the two scenario model combinations that were looked at. You can see that temperature is variable across space, not shown here, so it's a variable across time. That's key for addressing climate changes, but this also changes meteorology, so stagnation events. And then when you look at actual air quality, now in addition to the temperature change, you're also dealing with what are the pollutants in any given area for the impacts of climate on air quality. What you often see in model studies that have looked at this is that in remote areas with cleaner air, the higher temperatures actually lead to a decrease in some of the traditional pollutants like ozone. But in areas that are polluted, or that have higher ozone precursor levels, you get this increase in ozone. And so here you're seeing in the 8.5 scenario, a large increase in the heartland, somewhat less so in the RCP6 scenario, which is both not as warm, but also, I apologize, you know, it's two different models, so it's hard to tell what's the model and what's the scenario. But we can then take these ozone levels and use them to model health. I will point out here that we did not look at PM, which is obviously an important climate pollutant, but in general, climate effects on PM are considered to be less certain, with the potential exception of wildfires. So I think there's a study by Jonathan Paps that's being presented on Wednesday, I think, that includes a wildfire component. But this study was limited to ozone. And so we can actually go and calculate then the change in premature deaths in 2030. Or in this case, and you can see that sort of you get the change in deaths is mostly happening in urban areas, both because that's where people live and that's where also the air quality changes are the largest. And even though in some areas you actually see a decrease, the net effect overall is for a climate-related increase in mortality based on this modeling effort. So that's the air quality work, which is sort of the field that's most mature of the three that I'm going to be talking about. For infiltration, we're talking about indoor versus outdoor pollution. People spend a large amount of their lives inside, and so people are beginning to realize that thinking about indoor exposure is extremely important. There was an NCA assessment addressing this. It's especially important when you're thinking about pollutants with shorter lifetimes because they don't make it inside. If they don't make it inside in time, they'll decay and react and people won't be exposed to them. For indoor pollutants, obviously the more ventilation you have, the less you're exposed to radon or whatever other pollutant is being made indoors. There had to be some simplifying assumptions for the study. One was what temperature do people keep their homes at? And so there was basically every season we looked at historical average temperatures, and that was the sort of what we assumed would be held constant in the future, because the larger the difference between indoor and outdoor temperature, the more ventilation you'll get. There's assumptions about the default home type, and then we can look at modeling for wind speed and temperature and then how that affects the ventilation. And I am not going to go into detail about these changes. But you can see that this is changes by month, by city, in a lot of places. They are most of the increase in infiltration is happening in the summer, a decrease in the winter. This is a large part driven by the changing differential between inside and outside. So the summary is we're seeing less air exchange, especially in the winter, so increased exposure. And the net effect of climate change on exposure depends, like I said, on changing behavior, on changing building infrastructure, and since I mentioned the climate change penalty from the previous talk, changes in outdoor air pollution are going to matter for what the net effect of the change in ventilation is. So to move on to the third study, which is Lyme disease. So here the authors determined that they were unable to actually calculate the change in the number of Lyme cases in the future, but what they could model was the change in when people will start getting Lyme disease. And this is of definite interest, obviously, to people, to health professionals who need to be on the lookout for Lyme cases. If the cases are happening a couple of weeks earlier and people, health professionals aren't ready for it, there might be misdiagnoses. So there's a number of relevant issues there. But this was based on a study, Moore 2014, that looked at historical causes of the onset week and determined a number of key factors that they found explained most of the variation. The cumulative growing degree days in the season, cumulative precipitation, saturation deficit, and proximity to the Atlantic coast. And so these regression factors capture a very complicated series of biological and behavioral changes, because it's everything from, you know, when are the tick nymphs most active to when are people spending the most time walking through areas where the ticks live. So there's a lot of historical data that was used. About 200,000 Lyme cases met the criteria for use in the historical regression from 92 to 2007. 95% of Lyme cases in the U.S. happened in 13 states. One of those states didn't record onset date of illness, and so we couldn't use it in the study. So it was the remaining 12 states in the Northeast and Upper Midwest. And onset was defined by the maximum acceleration in case reporting. And then the climate variables that were used were state-based but weighted by the number of cases in the counties. The counties which have the most Lyme disease cases were given the most weight in this state-weighted average. So for future data, we use the CMIP models, and the modeling group chose the best models as evaluated by Newdy et al., and then chose them from four different model genealogies to try and get a variety of different modeling futures. And then they used a bias correction to match it to historical data. So here are the results, and you can see that in 2030, the best estimate is that Lyme disease will start being seen about half a week earlier, but in the 2070s, it'll be 0.7 to about 2 weeks, depending on which emission future pathway we follow. So 0.7 weeks is RCP 2.6, 1.9 weeks is RCP 8.5. And they found some other interesting sort of changes, which is that onset in some states is more sensitive to a degree of warming than other states. And they went back to look at the original sort of historical data and show that that's also seen in historical data, that these temperature changes are really sort of associated that way. So to sum up, we were trying to advance the quantitative projections of the health impacts. Air quality and ozone is a robust literature, so we sort of just add an additional study where we could link all the way to mortality. Indoor air and Lyme were really, I think, novel approaches that looked at potential exposure changes. But the challenges of the availability of historical data to do these response relationships, the complexity of the chain from the driver to the impact, and the interaction with future behavior are issues that will make this sort of work challenging. But I encourage people to do this kind of quantitative projections. I think it would be very helpful. Thank you.